Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, everybody. I'm the one, or this is the one, and I'm Greg Gutfeld. Doesn't matter, really. I'm really excited about today's guest. Michael Schellenberger was once Time Magazine's Hero of the Environment. He was a Green Book Award winner and founder and president of Environmental Progress. But he's got a new best-selling book called Apocalypse Never, which I'm guessing has probably ruined a lot of his friendships. But I'm going to ask him about that. Michael, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, Greg.
My pleasure. You know, you were you're the scariest kind of skeptic because you come from the other side. It was like when I was young, I was the leftist, and that made me a better, I guess, non-leftist. But you were a climate activist for decades. But now your findings don't seem to align with the typical talking points that we hear over and over and again in the media. So what changed you?
Well, I was, I still consider myself an environmental activist. Yeah. I've been an environmental activist for 33 years. I think climate change is real. I don't think it's the end of the world. Mm-hmm. I don't even think it's our most important environmental problem. And I had been working on a book about nuclear power, which is a technology I think is very, very important, including for protecting the environment, but also for other reasons, including national security reasons. And then last year, things just got crazy. Mm-hmm. And Greta Thunberg started saying billions of, and Extinction Rebellion started saying that billions of people are going to die from climate change. My daughter's 14, so she's fine, but her friends genuinely aren't sure they're going to live long enough to have kids. Jeez. And that's just wrong to be, it's wrong kind of scientifically, factually, but it's also immoral in the sense that we should not be contributing to anxiety and depression among adolescents. And so I felt the need to just kind of go through all the different big environmental concerns, plastic waste, meat and vegetarianism, the Amazon, deforestation, fires, climate change, and just try to separate out the science from the science fiction.
Which you do a great job of. I want to get to the plastic part, but first, the interesting thing when you brought up Greta, I think there are two elements going on that are affecting children in different ways. Number one, to your point, the hysteria completely unhealthy. You're creating a generation of morose and kind of panicked neurotics, and I would know because I'm one of them. But that's one side of it. But the other side is by kind of turning her into some majestic hero inspires people to chase this kind of hysteria. So it's not just that we're all going to die, but we're all going to die. And look at the attention I'm receiving by saying this.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question of how much of the we're all going to die stuff anybody really believes. Mm-hmm. One of the things I point out in the book is that, the people that are out there moralizing about how we can't burn any more fossil fuels, can't have any more emissions at all, we have to stop right now. They say that right after they fly to Sicily to stay at a 5-star resort and be driven around in Lamborghinis, and so what's really going on? I mean, obviously some of it is the stuff that we talk about. It's virtue signaling, mm-hmm. conspicuous compassion. It's not just that I'm rich. I want you to give me attention for being more moral too. I mean, right. Isn't that what a Tesla driver is saying? No mm-hmm. disrespect to Teslas, but that's, why do I need to give you credit for being environmentally sound exactly? Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of that. I think there's also, this is a global elite that are really, that have been behind both the climate apocalypse, that are behind sort of wanting the United Nations to take control of our food and energy policies and restrict food and energy supplies around the world. And so I think they've seen with Brexit, the election of Trump, the reversion towards nationalism, they feel threatened and they've been seeking to sort of impose a kind of new morality, a new global order, a sense of control of the economy by a group of activist scientists in particular. And it's unethical because it is really at heart going after something that is really quite wrong, which is it's trying to reduce economic growth, not just in the rich countries, but also I document how they've been really trying to deny poor countries cheap food and energy, which is the basis for our prosperity.
That, I think, is probably one of the most powerful arguments that you make, is that what these environmentalists are doing is like it's almost the equivalent of they're on the life raft, and now they decide that life rafts are unsafe for other people. So they're like, they've got now that we've got the coal and we were able to create our societies and increase our lifespans and lead pleasurable lives with big, you know, with healthy families. We are denying that opportunity by saying you can't have coal, you can't have this kind of energy. And so what you end up having is you have these incredibly poor countries remaining poor, or worse, remaining poor and burning impure fuels that end up, you know, killing millions of people a year.
That's right. It's totally unethical. Yeah. It's, you know, it's this comes from this British economist, late 1700s. Who said there's too many people and we're all going to have famines. It's always been used to justify reducing food and energy supplies to people. It's always been used to hurt people. It's never been used to help people. Obviously, we help each other by having abundant food and energy, and we've been very successful at that. So there's something quite mean about it. I think there's something unethical about it. I think there's something quite imperialistic about it. I think that... you know, for most people, it's just kind of dumb, you know, like I buy the product labeled natural because that must be better for me. I don't think most people think about it.
Yeah.
You know, but there's a lot of the other things. I mean, you know, I point out that, you know, rich people don't want big wind turbines spinning near Cape Cod or Martha's Vineyard or all the really, you know, or the north coast of California. We don't want big wind turbines in our beautiful country. So we want to put them in Iowa and Wisconsin and Michigan and dump them there. We don't want them for ourselves. And then we accuse the people who are defending their communities and wildlife, including whooping cranes and bald eagles in these so-called flyover states that the global elite look down upon. We condemn them as somehow part of like some conspiracy to destroy the planet. It's just it's offensive. I wanted to expose the class elements to it, the global elements to it, which I think are very insidious. I mean, you know, there's big money to be made here. I testified now twice in front of the Congress over the last month, and each time I had Democrats say, well, you know, solar and batteries are so cheap now, they're cheaper than the electricity on the grid. And I was like, great. So then why do you need $2 trillion of taxpayer money, which is what the Biden plan calls for?
Oh, God. Amazing.
So there's money behind it. There's power. There's, you know, basically it's the motivations are bad and the mechanisms are bad. And so hopefully we can surface some of them and talk about them and try to blunt their power in the culture.
I hope so. I'm trying to remember if I heard this with an interview that you did with Scott Adams, and I can't – so forgive me if I get this wrong, because I tend to get confused at times. Talking about – there was a period of time where we kept hearing about plastic straws and turtles. Was that you talking about that? It was the plastic straws and turtles, that the plastic straws were hurting turtles. But it turns out plastic probably helps more turtles than harms turtles. That makes sense?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I opened the chapter on plastic with this famous viral video of a marine biologist named Christine Figener pulling a plastic straw out of the nose of a sea turtle.
Right. Yes.
And then that led to these bans on straws. And I point out that plastic straws are, you know, 0.01% of all plastic waste, and that it's a trivial issue. And then I point out, I mean, it's such a fun chapter to write, by the way, because I've worked on a lot of these issues over the years, but I never worked on plastic waste. So I got to discover these things for the first time in researching Apocalypse Never. Mm-hmm. And I was spending a lot of time in the newspaper archives, and I discovered just by accident that plastic was, of course, and what we call plastic today is made from petrochemicals. It's made from fossil fuels. Plastic used to come from whales and sea turtles, and we hunted the same species of sea turtle that the marine biologist was working with when she pulled the straw out of the sea turtles. The same species of sea turtle. We used its shells to make eyeglasses.
Right.
In fact, what we call tortoise shell glasses,
exactly,
which is that modeled. It's actually not tortoise shell. They misnamed it. It was turtle shell. So plastics have been a substitute for ivory and elephants, for the shells of sea turtles, and for many other things. So plastics are truly a blessing. There's still problems that we would all agree, which is that poor countries that don't have waste management systems, the plastic waste ends up going into the ocean. In fact, sometimes people don't know this. The dirty little secret is that we really don't recycle most of the plastic that we think we recycle. It usually is shipped to Asia and then often ends up in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
You're better off just putting it in the landfill or incinerating it, which is what they do in Europe and Japan. But the point is, and this is the underlying argument of Apocalypse Never, which is that we need economic development to protect the natural environment. If you want to prevent plastic waste from going into the oceans, then poor countries like Thailand and Vietnam and other poor countries around the world, Africa, they need growth. They need economic development. And that's how they can afford, first, by the way, to take care of human waste, which is actually deadly if you don't take care of it. And then the second is to take care of plastic waste. And so we shouldn't be trying to keep countries poor. Anybody that's concerned about too much plastic waste in the ocean, and indeed, in some cases, it is a problem. I don't think it's the biggest problem, but it is a problem. Then you should want to have economic development.
Yeah. You know, it was such an interesting turnabout in the COVID climate when I'd written something in a book about 6 or 7 years ago about the studies on plastic versus cloth bags, and how there was a higher rate of food poisoning in the Bay Area. There was a study in, like, you know, Marin County, San Francisco, Oakland or something. And they found that the more, you know, people that shifted from what they looked at the post plastic bag ban, and they saw a rise in ER visits, and they could even calculate the number of deaths due to food poisoning based on this switch. So, but then the COVID pandemic starts, and now everybody kind of has to admit that plastic is preferable to these bags, because these bags transmit bacteria and viruses. Maybe not to the extent that people thought it was for COVID, but it kind of, like, it brought us back to reality that that the plastic bag is actually not a luxury. It actually works because it's clean. It's one use, even if it's litter.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I'm in Berkeley, which is the most neurotic city in the world.
I live there. I went to school there.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we talked about this last time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I get out of the, I walk my dogs this morning. I go to this nature area. That's why we love it here.
Mm-hmm.
I get my dogs out, and, you know, it's like, you're mostly 6 feet apart from everybody and you're outside, for Pete's sake.
Yeah.
But if you don't wear a mask, you know, you get these dirty looks. Well, I got out of my car today, and this woman had a full-on plastic, like, hospital visor on.
Right.
And I was like, oh, gosh, now we got visors? You know, oh, God, you know. And she's not worried about the plastic waste. I mean, she's wants that.
Yes, you know, exactly. How hilarious is that? I mean, it's like they went from demonizing plastic to covering their entire bodies with it.
Absolutely. So I think coronavirus, I've been working on something. It's not ready yet, and it's probably too early to publish it. But I was going to write something which was like how coronavirus should make us better.
Right.
You know, which is sort of, you know, yeah, calm down about, stop terrifying children. I mean, children, it's like, if you want to, like, and even if you're skeptical of the locked, if you think that we've over-responded, which is, I know a lot of my conservative friends do, even if you think that, clearly the thing that disrupted society is a disease, not some, you know, and there's no scenario under any IPCC, which is the big scientific body, or any other scientific body, which predicts more deaths in the future or more deaths from disasters or disease in the future, because economic development continues to outweigh the effects. So it's not to say that climate change isn't having any effects, but it's to say, we keep getting better thanks to economic development at taking care of our loved ones and preventing them from dying in disasters or getting infectious diseases. And this coronavirus pandemic will pass. And we should just pause for a moment and appreciate this beautiful civilization we've created before trying to just tear down every single institution in it, from the universities to the police departments to the
and have nothing.
The book kind of gets to. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, it has, and nothing to replace it. And by, I just want to, you mentioned economic development, and it's kind of interesting that, like, it drives me crazy to hear people saying that climate change is making natural disasters worse. And then you look it up, and it's, okay, I'm going to go in three different directions here. And you look it up, and it's not true. It's often real estate development that makes it appear that natural disasters are worse because people have moved, have built out further and further on the coast. That's part of my point. The other point of it is, if you adopt the climate change kind of scold mentality, you actually don't have to do the research because you're on the side of the angels. Whereas somebody like you, you really have to do the research because you have to prove them wrong. You don't have the luxury they have. They can just say we're in crisis, and I don't even have to show you the statistics. You know,
that's right. I mean, on Saturday, I kind of replied. I don't know what that's called, where you sort of reply to a tweet, but you embed the tweet that you're responding to in yours.
Yeah.
Greta Thunberg had tweeted a video of a flood in Niger, which is a country in Africa, mm-hmm. and she attributed it to climate change. And I just wrote, you know, Greta, that's completely misleading and irresponsible. The mm-hmm. flood in Niger is because they don't have a flood management system, a modern flood management system, not because of a couple more inches of rainfall from climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I've had a lot of people kind of go ask me, you know, do they know? Does she know she's being, being manipulative? Does she know that she's being misleading? I saw today she retweeted basically a levee or a dike collapse mm-hmm. in Spain. And I'm like, are you really suggesting that a couple more inches of rain destroyed the dike? If it did, then the dike was bad to begin with.
Exactly.
And so this idea, there's a kind of, I can't help but sort of, because I pay attention to these other, obviously these other things, the view that they sort of paint of humans is that we're these helpless victims of nature, which is bizarre because, of course, the big environmental problems that we as conservationists and environmentalists should care about are because humans are not helpless victims. We're incredibly powerful. We change landscapes, we transform the environment. In fact, that's what we worry about when we worry about our impact on the environment. It's not that we're somehow going to all just be swept away. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the other thing is that I point out that environmentalists are more alienated from both the natural environment mm-hmm. and the means of production.
Right.
Than say people who work in factories or work on farms
yes.
and who deliver the groceries and deliver the food. So does Greta Thunberg know that her home does not get flooded every year because her Swedish great-grandparents built a flood control system? She may not know that.
No.
She may not even see it. So in some senses, it's just, I mean, this is where at the end of the book, you know, the last chapter, I kind of go, what's going on here? And it's hard to be too, I say the chapter's called Lost, you know, it's called False Gods for Lost Souls. Greta Thunberg, she's a lost soul. She has no idea
right.
you know, what she's talking about, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in the grip of a kind of a lousy religion.
Yep.
You know, and she thinks she's sort of talking about stuff that's scientific, but she's just on a kind of religious crusade. And that raises some challenging questions for all of us, but it does, I think, put some of the hysteria in perspective.
All right. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
And I know you've said it before, it is a religion. It's a cult in the sense that you can rise up the cult based on how pure you are, right? Like the louder and the more, and the, you know, you could, the stronger you are on that side, and the less forgiving you are to opposing voices, the more you rise up, right? It's the more ideological, the more unbending, I guess is the word. The more unbending you are on climate change, the more you're rewarded. So if you are actually somebody like you or Bjorn Lomborg, who could say like, look, I believe there's climate change. I believe it's getting warmer. I believe that maybe humans have something to do with this. But I also believe that nuclear power is probably the cleanest energy. I think innovation is going to help us. So that sense, that sensibility in that sense does not put you up into the front row for the media, because that doesn't work for the media. Needs, I call it the prison of two ideas. You got to be evil or you got to be on their side. And in this case, on their side, it's Greta, and on evil is you. But if you are like actually, if they actually wanted to solve something, it would be way into the middle where there's a little bit of conflict, a little bit of disagreement. But at the end of this conversation, there's actually progress. They don't want progress. They just want discontent, which leads me to my last question. I was thinking of a great experiment. What if you published two books at the same time? As the same person, maybe change some spelling in your last name. One is Apocalypse Never, and the other one, The Coming Apocalypse. And just see if the people that read The Coming Apocalypse know that you wrote the other book, or and just compare which one we get the most media play. I'm just because the thing is, I do think that your, obviously your book is a daring book. It shouldn't be a daring book, but it is. But it's probably getting punished for the very thing that you're saying, if that makes sense. Right.
Well, the great thing about when your opponents are religious zealots is mm-hmm. that they always go too far. And so when they censored me,
yeah,
which they basically did. Mm-hmm. I mean, I first had my Forbes column censored.
Right.
Ostensibly for non-substantive reasons, though. I don't agree.
What and happened the to Forbes?
Was,
do you remember how good Forbes was? I mean, you can't say anything, but I can't.
Well,
Forbes was like a Forbes.com is strange. Anyway, that's just my opinion. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's fine. And then they've come after me in other ways. And then the worst was when I testified in front of Congress, mm-hmm. two of the Democrats on the hearing attacked me for like 10 minutes using their entire period of time
right.
just to attack me personally. And then I asked for a chance to respond. Another congressman on the hearing said, Michael should have a chance to respond to these slanderous attacks. They gaveled the meeting to the hearing to a close. And, you know, I wrote about it because I think that, you know, when they have to censor you, I think people know
yeah.
that there must be something really important going on. And I think that's been what's helped to make the book a bestseller. I think it's what's helped to get people to kind of go, maybe there's something else going on here. I do think the big event, though, is just that coronavirus and the pandemic is going to make us all aware that, you know, and we're headed for some dark times, I think. Mm. I think it's going to make us all aware that we should be grateful for our prosperity and civilization and not view it as something that has to radically change to deal with climate change.
All right. Well, then I can't end this here. I just need one more question. You said dark times. What is your definition of dark times?
It just seems like, I mean, the biggest problem, as you know, and I think you talk about a lot, is just that it doesn't matter who I talk to, Democrats or Republicans. I kind of go, why should the United States of America exist? And I can't get people to give me a very good answer to that question. Mm-hmm. And until we can have a great answer to that question, and until the answer to that question is broadly shared by left and right, by people in the blue states and the red states, we don't know what we owe each other. And we saw mm-hmm. this with the pandemic. We don't know what we owe our fellow citizens. And
right.
the divide is so... I will say, I think that we're going to go through a bunch of dark times, but I think it's going to mean change too. And I mm-hmm. think that whatever happens in the fall with the elections, there's going to have to be change because the global order is completely changing. And I think Americans, to some extent, I think the spoken or unspoken view from a lot of Americans is that we really do need to put the United States of America first. Mm-hmm. And anybody that wants to try to do something different is just not going to have the power that they've had over the last 30 years.
Yeah. I think that you put it succinctly. I mean, we don't know what we owe each other. It's such an interesting way to look at it. And Oh, God.
My wife, I got my wife on Twitter. One last story. I know you have to go, but I got my wife was like, get me on Twitter because she, because we're both basically Berkeley liberals, And so we read the New York Times and we were like, in the middle of the pandemic, we're like, the New York Times is not providing a diversity of viewpoints. So finally she was like, help me get on Twitter. I got her on Twitter and she was reading some back and forth on my Twitter thread. And a woman said, well, I hope people stay at home because my sister is immune compromised. And then somebody responded, oh, so we all have to stay at home because of your sister. Hmm. And both Helen and I were like, well, that's not very nice. It's not the nicest way to put it. But as I thought about it more, I was like, I think if you kind of give him the benefit of the doubt, he's not asking an unreasonable question, which is the question that we're all asking ourselves, which is what do we owe each other in a pandemic? But I think that just is we don't know what we owe each other when we weren't in the pandemic.
Exactly.
It's like we need to have something that reasonable Republicans and Democrats can agree on or our country is lost.
Yeah. You know, in a weird way, you're talking about what we used to see as war. Like the war answered the question, what do we owe each other? Do we I'm going to war to defend, to protect your family. You're going to war to protect my family. What what is sacrifice? What is expected of us? And I think the pandemic, we're in a world where the idea of world war just seems so far removed, and the pandemic in a way is kind of a new reworking, a reboot of war for us. The enemy is tiny, microscopic, invisible. But it's still kind of there, and maybe it's the same. It may be the same kind of thing in a way. I don't know.
Well, don't we all agree that the enemy is China? I mean,
yeah.
They're accelerating. It appears as though China has accelerated its genocide of its Muslim minority during the pandemic. And explain to me. I mean, I can't find a Democrat or a Republican who thinks it's a good idea to turn over the global market for nuclear energy.
Yeah.
90% of our drone market.
Ugh.
5G and 90% of our pharmaceuticals.
It's
we
insane.
We need to bring back some of these manufacturing. We need to have an industrial base to be a country. And that means that we have to, something is going to change. It's the subject of my next book, which is really what this question of what do we owe each other? And that means we're going to have to bring back some of our industry. We need more housing in the city. I think there's actually going to be more room for some broader agreement between left and right as we take a hard look at kind of what's a priority given coronavirus and the recession. And in a world where China is clearly does not respect human rights, it does not respect liberal democracy, and it seems like we really should be united against a China that threatens the world.
Yeah. Well, I hope that's true, but I just don't see any unity. Maybe I'm in a cable news bubble, so I think that everybody's at each other's throats. But I hope I'm wrong, Michael. It's a pleasure talking to you. The hero,
you too,
of
Greg, always great.
Yeah, the hero of the environment. You still are the hero of the environment. The book Apocalypse Never is a massive bestseller. I'm not going to ask you where you can get it because everybody knows that. You can go wherever you want to go, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookstore. And it was a pleasure talking to you, and I hope to see you soon sometime, Michael, when you're out in New York.
I'd love that. Thanks, Greg.
Sure thing. Take care.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.